all this bringing the narrative back, but a certain amount of mea culpa within some of the mainstream, slightly, but on the one hand they're still pushing it, and on the other hand they're trying to roll it back slightly. It's all a delicate balancing act, I think, that they have. And, you know, at the moment, I think Davos is ongoing, isn't it? The annual World Economic Forum, which again, apparently they're holding online again because of the so-called threat of the Omicron variant. And what I wanted to highlight is what Dr. Mike Yeadon pointed out, like last year, he actually brought this up, and nobody has openly challenged him about it. Nobody has called him out and said, no, 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 that's a lie. This whole narrative about variants is based on complete fallacy. According to Mike Yeadon, and this is, you know, basically scientific fact of virology, variants are at, even if they're the most different to the original version, are no more than 0.3% different. So he used an analogy and he said, for example, if you think of a human being, a whole, you know, myself, my whole self, as a equivalent of a virus, you know, the whole entire sequence of a virus. If I changed my glasses from, you know, one style to a different style, and then walk about outside on the streets and bump into friends and family, are they going to not recognize me with different glasses on? No, of course not. They'll recognize me. And that's exactly what variants are. So if you get infected with a virus or whatever and it replicates in your body, he describes it as a replication process which has typos in it, literally a couple of letters here and there. And when that typo replication is then found in somebody else, and they say, oh, well, this is a variant. It isn't. It's basically the same thing that anybody who has natural immunity to will recognize and deal with. So it's not a threat at all. And as he pointed out, people who had been infected with the original SARS-CoV-1, you know, however many years ago that was, 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, they tested those people with the new variants, or the next so-called COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, and they were immune to it, even though it was considerably more different. You know, the original SARS-CoV-1 is considerably different to this one. There's a 20, it's different by 20%, whereas the variants of SARS-CoV-2 are only 0.3% different. So this whole narrative now that's based on this moronic variant, that is all just, it's just moronic. You know, it's just deliberately trying to push this agenda further and further and further forward, because they're, you know, not getting there fast enough, because people aren't taking their boosters.
No, there's also, these tiny variations in the genome, it seems to me, if that tiny variation takes place within the small section of the genome, which is the SARS element, which has been causing the cytokine storm, etc., if that happens within that small element of the whole virus genome, I mean, it completely changes the character. Although it doesn't change the look of the virus to your immune system, it completely changes the effect of it to the body and the fatality ratings and that sort of thing. But it seems to me the biggest threat of Omicron, I mean, what do you want to call it? Omicron? Omicron, you know, is the threat is to the lies and to the mega vaccine agenda, the 17 billion people that are supposed to be being vaccinated the whole time. The main threat is to that whole narrative.
Yes, because, you know, again, that variant is, I mean, I don't even like talking about it as a variant because there's no substance to it. It's just part of this narrative. And, you know, discussing it basically validates it. There is nothing to it. You know, the people who are testing, so-called testing positive to it, and even the testing is ridiculous because, you know, the PCR testing for the original strain, they had to basically identify three specific spikes or whatever, three specific parts of the genome out of this megalong genome. So 3 points. And if they confirmed those 3 points, then that meant it was a positive. And then in the next load of PCR testing for Delta and whatever, they only had to confirm two or something. And now for Omicron or Omicron, they only have to even, they don't even have to find one. I think it's something like if there is no evidence of the previous three means that it's Omicron. I mean, it's just ludicrous. The testing itself is ludicrous. There is no factual basis to that. And so anyone who's been double jabbed is likely to test positive. What does that even mean? You know, the whole testing thing is farcical. It has been from the start. Testing healthy people is farcical. It's nonsensical. The whole thing is beginning to collapse in on itself. But they're still pretending or still insisting that the emperor has clothes. And the harder they push this nonsensical narrative, the more people are going to wake up from the dream.
Well, you know, I think they are. So they certainly are. And the other thing which has helped people wake up a bit is by seeing their friends, family and loved ones over Christmas in England. Obviously, in other parts of the UK and other parts of Europe, people have been meeting up with their families. It's very difficult in some parts, in places like France, etc., in Ireland with the curfews. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so this is continuing largely in, you know, in the EU countries in Europe. And also, of course, in the pro-EU leaning parts of Britain, which are, you know, the Tony Blair set up Senedd in the Welsh Assembly, and of course Holyrood in Scotland, and they seem to have come a bit of a cropper because the people will not be happy, and particularly the hospitality industry will not be happy and are not happy at all with Mark Drakeford and Nicola Sturgeon bringing in all these restrictions before Christmas and New Year on their most, you know, the most profit making time of the year for them, and then actually not providing any kind of compensation. So the Westminster government saying, well, you can do that if you want, but we're not paying for it. So there's been a sort of political fallout. Of course, also now a couple of weeks after New Year, into the New Year, we've got this assault on Boris Johnson. And, you know, the idea to me seems rather strange that this event after at the end of the day at Downing Street in the garden with the same people outside in fresh air who had been inside during the day somehow is a resigning issue. So what do you make of the sort of politics of Christmas and New Year here and now with Boris too?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Labour Party, ostensibly Labour, there are far, far greater issues that need scrutiny than, as you say, there's this party where, you know, these people are meeting on a day-to-day basis, on a weekly, hourly, daily basis, whether they're doing it for fun or for business, it is neither here nor there. That the key issue, which is, again, which is what they want everyone to focus on, and they want all the debate to be to relate to, is this question of, are you following rules or not? Now, as I was saying to my husband the other day, it's not, you know, they can't, what they should be doing is going after the fraud and the abuse and the corruption within number 10 Downing Street and within the Tory party and this whole entire process of undermining the, the social structure and the economic structure and the judicial structure of the country, what they and the national health system, or all of that. There are multiple issues that they could challenge the Tory government on, and specifically Boris Johnson on. But instead of that, they don't want people to focus on that issue because everyone is culpable. What they want people to focus on is this issue of obeying the rules, because that can then be applied to everybody. So, you know, people are beginning to feel that there's a lot of anger and regret, I think, by people who felt that they were doing the right thing by complying, by locking down, by not going to see their families at Christmas, by not visiting their elderly relatives in care homes and so on over the Christmas period if they were able to. And then, you know, those same loved ones maybe dying, or, you know, I mean, it was all of this pain and suffering that people basically signed themselves up for by complying. They feel like mugs now. They feel like fools because, you know, clearly the powers that shouldn't be didn't apply those rules to themselves, because they don't believe in them fundamentally. The rules are not for them. The rules are for us. And that's going to be increasingly clear as we go on. And it's all about this narrative of obeying rules, of following restrictions, and so on. And it's not about challenging power, holding power to account, and exposing corruption and lies, and because they don't want people to focus on those issues.
What about this? I mean, it seems to me that there's almost an enormous kind of cycle. I mean, we talk week after week about this as a psychological operation, but you know, all of the injustice that was done, what Professor Alison Pollock called the barbarity of not allowing people to see their loved ones before they die. I mean, we had this directly in my own family with my cousin who lives just 20 minutes down the road from my aunt, being told, oh, she's being taken into hospital, asking which ward she was in. He was going to come and visit her, and being told no, and then getting a call 45 minutes later to be told that she was dead. I mean, these kinds of barbaric acts, that, you know, him being able to hold his mother's hand in the last minutes of her life being denied. And the idea being that, I mean, obviously there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people across the country with similar, you know, having obeyed the rules. But the idea is to focus their ire onto Boris Johnson rather than to the bean counters like Van Tam Witty and people like this. I mean, admittedly, it's Boris who signs this stuff off, but it's these policies are all prepared by a massive machine. The Wellcome Trust, the Gates Foundation, all of those big institutions that they fund, the revolving doors with the government policymakers at Sage and NervTag and people like that. So the idea, it seems to me, is to focus that anger and the injustice, the feeling of injustice, onto Boris, whereas actually I sit and think, well, hang on, who is going to replace Boris? Is it Rishi Sunak? Is it the billionaire Goldman Sachs class? Or is it Liz Truss, who I don't really see as a credible foreign secretary, let alone someone to lead the country through the whatever events may be coming through the next few years? So anyway, what do you make of this attempt to focus everything on Boris?
Yeah, well, I think you're right, Tony, that, and he's a fall guy at the end of the day. He's his job's done, presumably. He managed to push the agenda as far as he could, and he's done very well by playing the sort of clownish figure, almost kind of reluctantly being forced into the decisions. That was the impression that was kind of presented in the last 2 years, was that he didn't want to do these things, but he was following the science. And so, he was sort of almost as though his arms were being twisted. And so once again, they can, the so-called left, the fake opposition in the Labour Party currently, could play the card of, exposing Boris as being purely interested in money and finance and the business class, and that he didn't care about the vulnerable. We knew that already. I mean, anybody with any sense for the past 10, 15 years knew that, they don't care about the vulnerable and the weak. But the fake Tory, a fake Labour Party, basically carried on playing their part in this charade by suggesting that, Johnson was his ridiculous concept of herd immunity, as they like to portray it, still to this day, was a granny killer policy, and that you had to basically follow the science, the scientists who really cared about granny, and the Labour Party and the unions who are all big time granny lovers, when in fact it was their lockdown policies that caused the greatest harm by isolating all these poor elderly folk, who, by the way, there's a new article research out about the mental, about the torture, basically, that these poor elderly, vulnerable people in homes who've just, they've just lost out on 2 years of family time, of, spending quality time and seeing their loved one faces, and, as you say, holding their hands and so on. I mean, the quality of life has diminished drastically for those who spend most of their times sitting in a communal living space with the television in a corner and very little activity to, enliven them and cheer them up. And to not be able to see their loved ones at a time like that is just, it is, as you say, barbaric and criminal. And the whole narrative is topsy-turvy and it's upside down and it's confusing. And it's deliberate in a way. It's this chaos theory, and the left are, in the form of the fake Labour Party, are just as, if not more, complicit and more culpable, because they did not continue not to challenge these totally nonsensical and farcical policies. But that's because this is an agenda. And the agenda has always been about the transfer of wealth upwards, the destruction of the working classes, of their of the approximately 20% of the workforce, to get rid of that 20%, because they're bringing in, or they're attempting to bring in, the fourth industrial revolution. And it's this massive reset, this massive financial and technological transformation underway. And the people who are pushing it, as you say, are not the leaders of governments, are not the representatives of political parties. They're far up and beyond that. In fact, those people are at the very bottom of the rung. I think one individual who's really explained this and kind of drawn all the threads together most astutely at this point is researcher and journalist Ian Davis, who on his blog In This Together, he explains exactly how this works. So he has a graph, which if you go to his website, in-this-together blog, he has a three-part series on what he calls the global public-private partnership. And I think, you know, I may have brought this up previously, but it basically, that's a fascist concept. And I, you know, it goes, I think, back to Tony Blair's Third Way. And it may be that, you know, that's why Tony Blair was given the Order of the Garter, because he has, you know, he set the ball rolling. And so here we are with this global public-private partnership where the corporate interests or the corporate stakeholders dictate the agenda. They finance the agenda, and then it's left to the various other stakeholders in the forms of think tanks and NGOs and government entities to then promulgate it. So he divides, so in this very illustrative graph, if I can just briefly describe it, he breaks the whole sort of pyramid, if you like, into five parts. And at the very top, obviously, of this pyramid is the policymakers. And at the pinnacle of this policymaking top of the pyramid, he places the Bank for International Settlements. He says that they ultimately control the money supply, and thus they can control the global markets, trade, and national economies. Then below the BIS is the central banks, and you know, they set forth their policy of going direct, which meant directly funding government spending, and that monetary policy has become fiscal policy. So they are controlling government policy. The next level of policymakers is the group of people that most, or the group of organizations that we are mostly aware of and mostly like to point our fingers at. And that's people like the World Economic Forum, the Council on Foreign Relations, Club of Rome, Chatham House, the Rockefellers, as an example. And these people, they formulate the policies which achieve the policy makers' objectives, they sort of work in partnership with the central banks and the Bank of International Settlements to convert their sort of think tank policies into political policy. So they all, those three categories form policymakers. And then the next level down are policy distributors, as he describes them. And these policy distributors are the big international policy organizations like the UN, like IMF, IPCC, World Bank, World Health Organization, NGOs, global corporations, and philanthropists like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Gates Foundation. So they are the group that take the think tanks' policy directives and distribute them to the policy enforcers. Now, the policy enforcers are the next level down, and so they're the third level on this pyramid, and they are governments, national governments and all the organs of government, and various selected scientific authorities. So as you can see, they're quite far down this chain of command, and they're the ones turning these concepts and objectives and agendas into various national government policies. And then, of course, that is then, spread about and broadcast by the various propagandists and information warfare specialists. And these include, obviously, the mainstream media, fact checkers, social media platforms, and various other groups like the 77th Brigade and anti-hate campaigns or campaigners. And then right at the bottom, there's us, you know. So we receive all of this plethora of propaganda from above, and we're merely there to basically follow orders and consume their products. I think that's a pretty good representation of where we are now at. These various policy makers in the form of the banks and the big think tanks have been directing the trajectory of global policies. Well, you know, I don't know how far back you want to look, you know, when it comes to that, because people talk about all wars being bankers' wars. So, you know, it can go back maybe to the dawn of civilization, who knows? But here today, it's impacting on, 6-7 billion people of the world.
Yeah, it's interesting, I think, that, putting these banks at the top, actually formulating policy, I think, it's difficult sometimes to see how that might work out at ground level. And I'd like to just use a couple of examples, because we've seen, for example, HS2, the £111 billion project to build a slightly faster railway between London and the north of England, and also the smart motorway system. That is something which has just been in the news this week. They're now saying, well, actually, we're going to have to bring a halt to this because it's killing people. Both of these, I think HS2 is pretty clearly a white elephant. Much better for the public would be to be investing that money in reopening the 1960s railways, which were closed down, which would relieve enormously the stress on the roads and people driving, people less people getting knocked down, killed, less pollution, And also, of course, if the prices were reduced a little bit, that network would then become a much more comprehensive network where, you know, maybe double the number of people making a specific journey would be able to use a train because the network is much more comprehensive. So this hasn't really been thought through, but it's all been justified by economics. So they say, well, you know, if the train journey for a great wealth generating, tax generating business person is 10 minutes quicker, then, you know, they multiply that up, you know, oh, how many journeys? And they say, well, this is actually a good investment. And they're arguing that to a rather supine, weak government who just sort of tick boxes and say, yes, yes, yes. And because that's what governments that are put in there by bankers and the city do. Another example, well, we've got, you know, the examples of the railways, the smart motorways, is just simply looking at things like MI5, the security service, constantly saying how their role is increasingly protecting the economic well-being of Britain. Well, that's a similar justification. They're saying, well, we don't want organised groups, campaigners. We want to target them, disrupt them, create fissures in them, destroy them, because they're threatening profitability of corporations and, you know, and the government's tax revenue. So these sorts of arguments are playing out, I think, very much more than people realise in the day-to-day world.
Yes, and, you know, what they, you know, keep doing and what they've been doing for decades now is, and it's coming to a crescendo, is the actual, you know, gutting of institutions that were meant for the greater good, for the public. And so they cannibalize and they completely sort of deprive or undermine the workings of these institutions to the point where they're creaking at the hinges and they're barely functioning, and then, you know, under a sort of propaganda assault in the media, people turn against those institutions and regard them as being, you know, unreliable, unworthy, and so on. And so they're perfectly happy for them to be privatized and sold off and so on. And then, you know, and then years later, they begin to regret, you know. And I think that is exemplified by, you know, the British rail system, for example, and the privatization of every single aspect of the rail network. And then now we're seeing it basically unfold right before our eyes, the complete dismantling of the NHS and how they're, you know, how they've been gradually cannibalizing the most profitable parts of it. And I think, you know, if journalists were being doing their jobs properly in the mainstream media, they would present these examples and then ask, you know, these various public bodies, ask them how they can, on one hand, make a statement such as, oh, we've got to pull together for, you know, we're all in this together and we're investing in public health and so on and so forth. And then on the other hand, continue to reduce the number of beds in the ITUs, in the critical care units in hospitals. So year on year on year on year, the number of beds available or that are actually exist in British hospitals have continued to go down. And so, of course, year on year on year on year, every year, there is there has been this, you know, nightmare at winter time where people are lined up in corridors on beds, you know, because there just simply weren't enough beds, or on trolleys rather than on beds, because there simply weren't enough beds in the hospital. Now, that kind of scrutiny by real proper journalists, gets people thinking and makes them, you know, see the duplicitous and the complete corruption and the two-facedness of these politicians. But they don't. All they do is continue to broadcast and propagate the narratives that, oh, you know, the hospitals are overwhelmed and they can't cope and blah blah blah. And there's no context. You know, there's never any context to anything. But it's part of this. You know, we might as well be goldfish in a goldfish bowl for the length of memory that people have for what's happened year after year after year. It's, but as we say, you know, there are increasing numbers of really great analysis. There was another brilliant article today I read by Hiroyuki Hamada, which was in the blog Wrong Kind of Green. And that was a brilliant article, quite lengthy, but, you know, really goes into all of this manipulation of the public and the narratives that we are fed. And then, you know, this blog that Ian Davis has. So I think people, as we say, once they've woken up to this this con, which is driving us into, you know, a more controlled, a more, a much less free, much more proscribed environment that we live in, and completely controlled basically in our movements and our actions and our words and our behaviors and so on. Once people are more aware of that aspect, they're just not going to go back to sleep again. They're not going to say, oh, well, yeah, regardless of what I've become aware of, I'm going to carry on, you know, believing what the BBC tells me. I think in vast numbers of people now are, you know, refusing to pay the TV license because they're simply not willing to fund this type of propaganda anymore.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, Catherine, there's a whole nother load, probably the majority, at least two thirds, that actually quite enjoy paying their TV license because the TV is reassuring them, telling them what they want to hear, that actually it's okay, the government is in control, it's looking after your best interests, all you need to do is follow the vaccine program. And I mean, that to me, what that says is that as a psychological operation, it's being very successful because it's exploiting people's natural unwillingness to take on this massive idea that actually there is a, you know, as you were talking about the Bank for International Settlements and the rest of them, I would say even, you know, beyond that, there's been a terrific documentary series, a couple of different versions of it I've seen called Follow the Money. Which is, I think, begun by a Dutch woman looking at, it's called Follow the Money, How the World Works, BlackRock and Vanguard, where they're really looking at how so much of what we see around us, say, for example, you know, Shell and BP are on the opposite sides of the road, but actually the same company, is a complete illusion. What you're seeing there is really a cartel. The same with things like basic stuff like Coke or Pepsi, both owned by the same investment companies. And so that is something that people do not want to take on board, the idea that actually there is no democracy. And although they're buying into a whole sort of narrative of Labour, Conservative, Republican, Democrat, they're following the, you know, this stuff, people just simply don't want to go there. The idea that all this is just purely to manipulate them, because they've spent most of their lives you know, working along this system and understanding it and trusting it and believing in it. So there is a definite, I would suggest even the majority of people just simply don't want to overturn the, you know, the assumptions that they've made for most of their lives. And the perpetrators don't know this.
I guess that's true. And I think that's probably been true throughout history. I think now, though, the only thing that is maybe a chink in their sort of in their full frontal assault, as it were, is the fact that social media is a double-edged sword for them. So on the one hand, they get to learn so much more about people's behavior and thinking and, so they know how to better manipulate people because they are constantly sucking up every last bit of information that is derived from social media. But on the other hand, and of course they can weaponize that and use it against people, which they have done and are doing. But, on the other hand, just as when the printing presses finally sort of took hold and, it created a sort of revolution at the time, which was slow, but it snowballed to the point where the amount of knowledge that people had absorbed and was then distilled and passed down to the next generation and so on, that snowballed until eventually it reached a tipping point. And the only thing we can do is hope that, the harder they push, the more aggressive their policies, the more diabolical, the more human tragedies that are experienced on every level of society, that, those of us who are awake can gently direct that person's attention who is awakening to the real target rather than have them blame their neighbors, for example, for being unvaccinated or whatever, because that obviously that is, all of that is part of the full frontal assault, which is this weaponizing, basically blaming the unvaccinated for everything. And we're seeing that now, that narrative spilling out from Macron to Trudeau to all these other people who are basically, calling the unvaxxed, basically comparing them with lepers or any other kind of sort of people that are really the, filth and scum. And it's really, that is so incredible to see that it's actually got to that level where they have to dehumanize whole sections of society. And I think it will be a much harder job for them to succeed with that line, because obviously it will also eventually include the people who took the first two jabs and are refusing to get the booster. And each time they push for the next shot, there'll be fewer and fewer people wanting it because there's going to be more and more adverse events. And those sorts of adverse events and those kinds of kind of vaccine-induced or vaccine-related deaths and so on will, they do percolate through the various social media and just conversations in general, where people eventually might bring this sort of thing up, and then people realize there's more of it around than they realize. So that's the aspect of social media, I think, that they can't. I mean, obviously they're also desperately trying to control that and tamp that down now. I don't know if you're aware of this this guy called Craig Pardee Cooper. he's got a blog which has had millions of hits called How Bad Is My Batch? And basically, he created this sort of searchable database where you can enter your batch code or your lot number for your vaccine and see how many deaths or adverse events are associated with that batch number or that lot number. Because he took all of the data from, he extracted all of the data from the US system, VAERS, and perhaps from other databases as well, and, you know, inputted, so he associated all of the adverse events to each individual batch number and lot number and created this this graph and this searchable database. And it's literally opened up a whole can of worms, and it spread like wildfire. This, I mean, his website has been mirrored. I've just searched for in DuckDuckGo, and it's mirrored on tons and tons of other websites. So it's not only on his own website, it's now mirrored everywhere else. And Mike Eden has been looking into it. So all these people now are focusing on to the lethality and the toxicity of these jabs, and it's producing a lot of information. So there's a lot of information that people are now analyzing, which is throwing up all types of information that eventually, however long it takes, will be mirrored or will be reflected in the mainstream media eventually. But as everything else, they're always the last ones to cover the story, even though they try and claim that, you know, it was, you know, nobody got there before them. But
yeah, well, look, hang on, because where is this evidence that the batches are different? I mean, there was an occasion, I think it was it last April, that Johnson & Johnson had to withdraw an enormous number of their vaccine that had some sort of wrong ingredient. I mean, goodness knows how they managed to do that in their factory. But that, as far as I know, is the only evidence that there's any difference between the different batches of the different vaccines. These companies are producing an identical vaccine, millions of them.
No, they're not. And that's the problem. So when people make a report to VAERS, the US yellow card reporting system, they have to include, and I believe this is probably the same for the British yellow card system. However, the yellow card system in the UK, I don't think it displays the lot number or the batch number. But on the VAERS database, you can search it. It's a much more comprehensive system than the yellow card system in the UK. That you can search, you can search everything. You can search based on gender or sex. You can search based on various different, injuries and so on. And you can search based on the batch number. And so this is what he did. And so he created this database after he'd, obviously, I have no idea how he did it, but he inputted all that data, and from that he was able to extrapolate how many of the adverse reactions were associated with a particular batch number. And there is a huge amount of difference. And so there are multiple batches that basically don't seem to have any effect whatsoever at this point in time. You know, they, so if you have a graph between 0 and like 2000, for example, they are all floating down at the sort of zero level of having no effects or anything. But then every now and then there's this massive spike. And that specific batch number or lot number has generated a huge number of adverse events and even deaths. So, for example, today or yesterday, there was an article in the Defender, the website by Children's Health Defense, and it basically talked about this case of a 26-year-old young man who died of a heart failure, basically, and his after his death, there was an autopsy, and the autopsy confirmed that his booster jab was the cause of his death. So apparently he had a booster jab on the 8th of November last year, and 4 days later he was dead. His name was Joseph Keating, and they showed his lot number of his booster shot. And when you do a search on this Pardee Cooper's database, how bad is my batch, that batch number caused 530 reported adverse reactions. It has also caused 5 deaths, 3 disabilities, and 4 life-threatening illnesses. So, you know, this is what people are doing now. If this website becomes, and as I say, it's already had 1 million hits when I checked a couple of days ago, and that's why it's being mirrored everywhere so people can actually, you know, access it and search themselves. If you've had a jab, all you have to do is get your lot number, your batch number, type it into the search bar, and you'll be able to see exactly how many adverse reactions have been reported, how many deaths, if any, and so on.
Okay, well, what you're suggesting here is that there could be something entirely different going into people's arms if they get one batch or another batch, and potentially, possibly even nothing going into their arm. In other words, a placebo. I mean, that would require, I suppose, quite a lot of deliberate actions at the other end. In other words, the very secretive vaccine manufacturers and the processors that are boxing these things up, ready to go out or whatever they do. I mean, the other thing is, of course, here you could even get the situation where, say, for example, the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh get their vaccines at the beginning of 2021. And one of them gets something which is completely different to the other. One of them lives, one of them dies. I mean, this is a potential tool for assassination, even though it's, you know, being presented as something which is just the same stuff in every needle.
Yeah, well, it's very, very concerning. And of course, the fact that these vaccines are not required in the first place, the fact that they don't do anything, they don't prevent transmission or contagion, and, you know, all of these things. And the CEO of Pfizer himself has literally just come out the other day and said that basically these jabs don't protect you and they're not very useful. So they're,
well, hang on, you can't say they don't do anything, because surely, you know, at the very least, what they can do is, and they may, okay, so they may kill you and they may give you a serious injury, but they're much more likely just to simply stop you getting such a bad reaction to the virus that you end up in hospital. That's the point of them.
Well, that's what they claim is the point of them. But I mean, I don't think there's any real evidence of that when you really scrutinize the evidence in a non-biased way, because, if that's really true, then why is it that more people are in hospital who are vaccinated than aren't. But I mean, I think we can debate that endlessly. The point is that, you know, if people are going to get ill, they're going to get ill. And this focus on antibodies that, you know, this whether or not you have antibodies is just not even half the picture. It's just a tiny segment of the picture. And the real issue that nobody's talking about is, do you have your natural immunity in the form of T lymphocytes and various other immune systems, long-term immune memory systems that you know, will protect you from any variant, from any version of this thing. You're neither asymptomatic or symptomatic. You simply, it just passes you by, and there's, you know, it's just a nothing burger for you completely. It doesn't affect you at all. The fact that they're continuing to, you know, insist that God knows how many, half the population of the US, or how whatever they're trying to suggest, that are susceptible to anything at this point, is utterly, utterly absurd. You know, there is absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever. What is really, really crucial to and more information will be coming out about, you know, the research that's going into the adverse events of these jabs. These researchers are not going to give up. You know, they've got their hands on some of the most, you know, detailed information. And they're not the only ones who know this. CDC know this. NIH know this. FDA knows this. They all have access to the same information that independent researchers do, but they're not presenting it. You know, this research is throwing out all sorts of things which are really concerning, such as the massive variation in lethality of these batches. But also, what's also coming out is the massive disproportionate level of harm to women than to men. So, you know, this is also something that needs digging into, which they are going to dig into. But on all of the various negative health outcomes of adverse events, women seem to be on balance twice as susceptible as men from the jabs. Now, why isn't that being investigated? Because if women are twice as susceptible, and sometimes more than twice as susceptible, sometimes three quarters, you know, susceptible, or three out of four times more susceptible, then why are they being advocated for women and not least pregnant and lactating, breastfeeding women? You know, it's just, all of this is all being investigated by people who have no skin in the game. They are simply concerned, very concerned investigative researchers and journalists. And this information is being voraciously consumed by a public who are absolutely desperate for some truth.
Yeah, well, I'd like to say, just round off with something a bit positive. I've been, you know, getting involved with various communities, gatherings, all these terrible things called face-to-face gatherings, you know, which are, you're supposed to feel guilty, apparently. And I had a terrific evening with some Stand in the Park people who were very well organised. I think for one reason or another, I'm not sure why, the countryside in Britain seems to be much more radicalized and understand this better than the cities. And it might be simply because, despite everyone being crammed together, people are more atomized in the city than they are, you know, and they are watching television more. Also, of course, they're more tied into the financial system with their high house prices, God knows what. Actually, maybe, you know, actually house prices in the countryside are higher, aren't they? So I better scrap that thought. But I mean, there seems to be a difference in the way that the urban population and the rural population, it might simply be because they tend to be more right libertarian in the countryside. But at this gathering, there were people of all ages that I went to last week. The pub was absolutely, I mean, I called it, even though it wasn't officially called that, stand in the pub, because you simply could hardly move. With a publican who embraces much of what we've been talking about and certainly is sceptical. And just as the evening was drawing to a close, people were sort of trickling away. I met for the first time a friend of a friend there and was introduced to him. And he's saying, is this just amazing synergy here? And I said, yeah, I can't quite. And he said, well, it's like the 70s. And a penny dropped for me there. In the 1970s, there was just a general kind of activism out there, an understanding that the government was not out for you necessarily, that there were big changes going on and that people needed to get together to fight it. And certainly not on social media, not on, you know, wherever the electronic digital data is. But, you know, it was just an absolutely brilliant realization that what we're going through now is it's almost like nostalgia, you know, for some of the best times of when I was a young man, you know. So I'd just like to leave us with, I don't know if you've got any closing thoughts, Catherine.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, people who do want to have a, you know, a real authentic life where, you know, they're not just married to a gadget, but rather they're genuinely involved in a sort of community, whether it's your actual physical blood relations or whether you've had to create your own sort of family who are on a more connected level with you. It, you know, it's best to drop the gadget, drop the phone, drop the tablet and get connected on a one-to-one, face-to-face level. And I think this year we'll see a lot more of that. But I also think that, you know, there are countries where they are going along with this agenda on a surface level, but their heart's not in it, and they're not buying it wholesale, and they're not delivering it wholesale to their public. So, I mean, for example, in Syria, just a couple of weeks ago, Vanessa Beasley was saying, you know, oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, up until now, we barely noticed whether COVID existed or not in Syria because people had much, much more serious things to worry about than COVID. And then out of the blue, they basically started talking about mandating the vaccines. And, you know, she was pretty gobsmacked, and there was all sorts of, you know, anger from the public because they literally, you know, barely wore masks in public buildings. You know, if you didn't feel like it, you didn't wear one. However, she then reported not so long after that they'd built in a whole load of exemptions to this mandate. So if you had any number of health problems, which vast numbers of Syrians could basically say that they did, you're exempt. So I think this is the way that some countries are playing it now, because they know this is destroying the economy, destroying their a source of funding, basically, you know, and yeah, so it's all you know, that it's a really, really delicate balancing act, I think, that the top sort of policy makers are walking, and they don't know what consequences their actions they can try and predict, but if their predictions are as good as the computer modeling coming out of Neil Ferguson's lab, then, you know, they're obviously far removed from reality.
Finally, look, you know, we've had all this, the discussions between the NATO countries, well, mainly the United States and then NATO and Russia. You're sort of sandwiched in the middle there in Turkey. I wonder what you make of it. Apparently, lots and lots of talking, which, of course, is much better than fighting, but nothing much coming out of it other than it doesn't look like anything much is going to change. What do you make of this whole relationship between Russia and NATO? And, you know, how do you feel being sandwiched in the middle in Turkey? Because Turkey is actually a member of NATO, but is doing things like buying high-tech Russian weapons.
Yeah, because the Russian weapons are far cheaper and probably more reliable. well, as I think I may have said earlier, it's pretty clear that the US is got regime change, you know, for Erdogan on its map, because we have someone in the form of John Bolton, who basically has joined some, you know, at the beginning of last year, it was April last year, he joined some, the New Century for Turkey or something it was called, some organization. So, yeah, I think they're targeting Erdogan, whether he's, you know, I mean, I certainly have no love for him. None whatsoever. But this, you know, he may actually be somewhat of a stick in the mud for the sort of this Agenda 2030 and the agenda that they're pushing with the fourth industrial revolution and so on. I think Turkey, a lot is going to be happening in Turkey, unfortunately. The financial situation here is pretty dire for a lot of people, really, really scraping the barrel here now. It's going to be interesting times ahead, I think. You know, famously, most Turkish people believe that, you know, the Lausanne Treaty that was signed about 100 years ago is coming up for expiry in 2023. And there is this belief that basically Turkey was required, or forbidden from accessing her own natural resources for 100 years. It was off the cards. Now, if this expiry, you know, in 2023 is honored, then in theory, Turkey is then supposedly free to do what she wants with her natural resources. However, Erdogan has gone ahead and privatized most of Turkey and sold it off to other nations and private corporations. But, you know, Turkey is a big country, does have a lot of natural resources. In fact, my husband tells a story of how when his high school was being built some 40 years ago or 50 years ago, when they literally started digging to make the foundations, it started gushing black, oily liquid. And he reckons they literally poured about 4 foot of cement on top of that to create the foundations for the high school. So who knows? I mean, it's all quite intriguing, really. And there's no doubt that the US and UK hegemonic imperial mafiosi will be desperate to once again get their teeth into Turkey.
Catherine Gunn, thanks again very much for joining us.